Hello and welcome to another episode of National Review's Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and I am enjoying a long winning streak of wonderful first quarter 2024 episodes, some wonderful guests lately, and including some first-time guests. And so we're going to have another one of those today. Looking forward to a really interesting conversation about some matters near and dear to the heart of those that care about the message of Capitol Record. Our guest today is Dr. Matthew. Now, Matthew, I have pronounced your name two different ways since we first met. So why don't you make sure that I'm saying this correctly in the pronunciation?
Matthew Finup.
Matthew Finup, not Fine Up. And so if you've heard me say Fine Up, then I apologize. We're going to go with Finup straight from the horse's mouth today. But Matthew is the director of an economic group that we're going to talk about here that I just had the privilege of speaking with that serves as a center out of Cal Lutheran University in Thousand Oaks, California. This economic center is one of a kind in that they are doing economic forecasting out of a distinctly Christian research university that is, I think, providing some of the finest data analytics and really application-oriented economic research available. It is the Center for Economic Research and Forecasting, and I think that Matthew's done a phenomenal job and is going to have quite a bit to say here today. So with that said, Matthew, welcome to National Review's Capitol Record.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's a real privilege to be here.
I think the little basic setup as to what the center is was fine, but I'd rather you just, in your own words, maybe give listeners a little understanding of what it is that you're seeking to do with the center. We'll call it CERF for short, but just remind people it stands for Center for Economic Research and Forecasting. What is CERF all about?
Well, so yeah, CERF is a really interesting place, and I guess to really understand what we do and why we do it, it's important to talk a little bit about the history. So the Center for Economic Research and Forecasting actually started at just down the road at UC Santa Barbara, an R1 research institute. My predecessor is an economist named Bill Watkins, and Bill Watkins and my colleague Dan Hamilton founded the Economic Forecast Project at UC Santa Barbara and ran a very well-known economic forecast center out of UC Santa Barbara for a number of years and developed a national reputation for their forecasts. That group, about 16 years ago, was sort of airlifted out of UC Santa Barbara by the president and the dean of the School of Management at California Lutheran University, and the entire team was brought over to a small, regional liberal arts university down the road, with the idea that CERF would sort of expand the visibility of the university and its academic reputation. And so Bill and Dan came over to CalU 16 years ago. I've been here for the last 10 years, and what's interesting there is that the commission I got from the president of the university when I arrived was, again, continue the forecasting work, really try and enhance the visibility and reputation of the university. But he also said your job is to really be part of the roots that the university has in the community. He really encouraged me to learn what the needs were in Ventura County here, where we're based, and then really try and use our skills to serve the needs of the community, to sort of make a difference. And so that has produced initiatives well beyond the economic forecasting work that we do. Things like starting one of the very first groundwater markets in California. We led a very ambitious COVID-19 antibody study trying to track the asymptomatic transmission of the disease during the pandemic. We've been involved in some really interesting demographic work trying to estimate the economic contribution of U.S. Latinos. And so it's produced just a number of really unique things. So we have our fingers in a number of really interesting initiatives.
Tell me a bit about the COVID project. That seems really quite particular, but also quite idiosyncratic from economic research. What was the genesis of that?
Yeah, so, well, I guess what's interesting as background there is that, first of all, Ventura County is interesting in that it was experiencing a prolonged period of economic weakness prior to the pandemic. Economic activity, the total economic activity contracted 15% in the 12 years before COVID. And we understood that that meant this was a fragile economy that was going to have trouble absorbing an impact like COVID-19. And we are also a place, though, that has just really proactive leadership at the local, county, and even our state representatives. And so early in the pandemic, our California Assembly member was able to secure a large batch of tests and really wanted to, antibody tests, and wanted to bring those to bear in the county to try and track asymptomatic transmission with the goal that we could get schools and businesses reopened as quickly as possible if the data allowed. Now, the challenge was that we were setting off on that initiative at the same time that antibody studies were being discussed in the Silicon Valley area and elsewhere, where the actual research design of those antibody studies came under some criticism, you know, about how they were sampling the population. In many cases, they were only sampling, you know, upper middle income individuals who, you know, who had internet access, that sort of thing. And so immediately the assembly member and county officials asked me to come on board and help to, you know, sort of work on the research design to make sure that we were getting a representative sample of the population. I happened to be working with two epidemiologists at UCLA on some other work, and so they came over and we conducted an absolutely remarkable survey. We drew over 15,000 blood draws in multiple waves in every single city, the county. It was this incredible partnership of county and city leadership. We were actually locating testing sites in census-designated disadvantaged communities and then canvassing neighborhoods to make sure we were getting samples from the people who are most likely to be undercounted. We recruited a cohort of people who tested positive, and we actually paid them. We had financial incentives for them to get tested repeatedly so that we could actually track the decay of antibodies after exposure. And so all of that led to a really amazing result, which is, first of all, we showed that asymptomatic transmission was very, very low. And that really gave local policymakers the information they needed to boldly open schools and open businesses. We were the very first county in California to reopen schools, in California, so operating within the restrictions the state put. We vaccinated the entire educational workforce in 1 month. It became a model for the rest of the state. And we also were one of the very first counties to reopen business. In fact, we're right at the county line. The county line runs through the town of Westlake Village. There were actually businesses on one side of the street that were open because they were in Ventura County. And literally across the street in LA County, businesses were closed. And so that's just one example where, you know, we're trying to use the expertise we have in data analytics, in research design, to really make a difference in our community.
In that particular case, and I guess this could be true of other projects as well, but I already know the answer to some of the others. Does it start with an interest in its application at a local level, but then give you an opportunity or interest in springboarding it to a national application?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I really sort of see the forecasting work that we do and the fact that we're part of, you know, major national forecast surveys like the National Association for Business Economics, Economic Outlook Survey, the Wall Street Journal Economic Forecasting Survey. That sort of gives us the national profile. Some of the demographic work that we're doing is allowing us to present to, you know, at system-wide events of the Federal Reserve, present to the Joint Economic Committee of U.S. Congress. And so, you know, there's a number of projects that are giving us that broad national exposure. And I feel like that gives us the credibility locally that when there's a real pressing issue, they invite us to be a part of that. You know, that was certainly true with seeding and then running the first groundwater market in California. You know, it was that reputation, that reputational capital that sort of gave us a seat at the table.
I see that there is an endeavor. You sent me some info on it, and I'm going to put some more into the show notes. But this issue regarding the Latino contribution to U.S. GDP, That strikes me as something that is inherently national. And even though it's being done out of what, you know, in your case is a local research center, it's on behalf of national data, national application. Tell us a little bit about that project.
Yeah, so we call this the Latino GDP Project, and our goal is to just provide a factual view of the large and rapidly growing economic contribution of Latinos living in the United States. What's exciting for me is that when we look at the data, first of all, this is just a wonderful economic growth story. You know, and as an economist, as an American, and I know you share the same, and I'm passionate about economic growth. And this is an amazing growth story. The other thing that's really unique is that when we look at Latinos in the United States, you know, they actually embody characteristics that are fundamentally American. You know, hard work, self-sufficiency, you know, patriotism, entrepreneurship. And so it's been really exciting being part of this project, trying to document that economic contribution. This initiative actually started around 2004. So my colleague at UCLA, Dr. David Hayes Bautista, who's an epidemiologist and a demographer, actually did some of the some early population forecasts of Hispanic population in California, and actually wrote a book called The Burden of Support, you know, talking about the increasingly important role that Hispanic Latinos were going to take in the U.S. labor force over the decades ahead. And as he was presenting that research around the country, he sort of felt like what was missing from the conversation was a summary statistic that really sort of captured the importance of Latino economic contribution. So it was in 2004 that he first started talking to economists about calculating Latino share of U.S. GDP. And so he worked with an economist named Werner Schenck, who was at the time the chief economist of the California Employment Development Department, EDD, and they crafted the original methodology to calculate Latino share of U.S. GDP. It's a very, very detailed bottom-up construction that leverages, detailed sectoral data on the components of GDP. It leverages data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Census Bureau, and then it estimates U.S. Latino GDP. So they released an initial report. Unfortunately, Werner Schenck contracted cancer and passed away. And David Hayes Bautista looked for someone who had the data expertise, who was familiar with public data programs and the analytics that would be required to carry that research on. And we got the first call. My colleague Dan Hamilton has a real reputation for expertise in economic measurement. And so we've now been partnering on this project for 6 years. We've released 5 annual U.S. Latino GDP reports. Bank of America has generously funded this work, and now we're working on state and metropolitan area Latino GDP reports. And what's really exciting about it, again, is we see the same patterns, you know, that Latino labor force participation is significantly higher than that of non-Latinos, and their growth of Latino educational attainment is much more rapid. The rate at which they're earning bachelor's degrees is growing more rapidly. And obviously those investments in human capital are translating into rapidly growing incomes among Latinos and rapidly growing Latino GDP. And so again, it's a wonderful growth story that's been exciting to help document.
Is the methodology, and I know you guys came into the project to kind of do a lot of the research out of the methodology that had been created, but is it when you look at what you just described, job creation, educational opportunities expanding, there seems to be some cause that then gives way to the effect. And I would assume the measurement of GDP is the effect, and then we can kind of analyze what we think caused it, right?
Sure. But
how is the effect primarily being measured when you talk about isolating an ethnic group within a national output? Is it largely consumption oriented?
No. So actually, the building block that we use is what's called the BEA's input output table. Mm-hmm. It's part of the national income or product accounts generally, but it's this amazing amazing series of accounts. There's the IO table, which documents 71 different categories of intermediate expenditures across 71 categories across the 71 industry sectors, right? And so it gives very, very detailed expenditures. And then also, it actually, then obviously, an expenditure is someone else's income. It also documents all of that as income across 71 sectors of industrial activity. And then that's used as inputs to the specific components of GDP. And so we actually are able to combine the BEA's input-output table with data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau to craft a Latino version of the IO table. And so
it's weighted to the sectors.
Yep, correct. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And so in these different projects, there's models that get built, and you guys are able to create your own models. You're able to combine various sources of information to help analyze and synthesize, and then present various applications or takeaways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, and again, in some cases, what's really fun is that we sort of have these core expertise. Areas of expertise, but then we're being invited into really exciting applications. I actually went to a PhD program at UC Santa Barbara that's famous for its work in environmental markets, but I was in a land use group, right? I was doing a dissertation on land use and urban growth restrictions, but I got invited into this process to build a groundwater market because of the reputation of SURF. And got to learn with stakeholders as we were building the first groundwater market. So it's been really exciting, some of the areas that we've been invited to apply ourselves in.
Well, I think that when you look at some of these more bespoke things, the COVID study is quite interesting. This Latino GDP project's fascinating and speaks to the reputation and sort of gravitas that you've been able to create already around the center. But let's hone in on home base a little bit. You and I spent some time talking a couple weeks ago when we were together about the kind of local economic growth and the case for economic growth and what is needed in your backyard. And this applies to the particulars of Ventura County. There's some fascinating takeaways that are evidenced that help explain why there's an increasing number of people that might be leaving various cities that are actually quite wonderful places to live, job defection, home price appreciation. And I just wonder if you could share kind of some of the main takeaways of what you see happening in the broader Ventura County area. The cities of Oxnard, Thousand Oaks are a part of this. I think there's going to be some parallels to a national conversation we'll bridge this into, but maybe give a little lay of the land for people all over the country. What's going on in beautiful Ventura County economically?
So again, as the background to that discussion, what's important to know about Ventura County is we engaged in a pretty radical land use and urban growth restriction experiment beginning in the late 90s. And so between 1998 and 2000, seven of the cities in Ventura County passed what are to this day the most stringent urban growth restrictions that you'll find in the United States. That was accompanied by a countywide measure that covered all of the county unincorporated land. And basically, in order to rezone land for development in Ventura County, you need a majority vote of the entire electorate. So we imposed strict urban growth boundaries around cities and said that you need to get the entire county electorate to vote to move those boundaries. And so this is, as I've studied land use policy, I've not found another set. There are urban growth restrictions are employed in something more than a quarter of all U.S. metropolitan areas, but there's none that are quite as strict as this. And so this has been it's called Save Open Spaces and Agricultural Resources, SOAR. Is the name of that suite of policies. And this has been a very, very significant restriction on residential development. And so we have just, you know, we have a deficit of something like 30,000 residential units since the policy was passed. And as a result of that, we have actually seen just dramatic home price appreciation. We just learned that according to the National Association of Realtors, Ventura County is now the single most unaffordable housing market of the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the United States.
And that is calculated off of a blend of average median income and median home price.
Yeah, it's actually, I believe their particular measure looks at the number of people who can afford, the percentage of the population that can afford the median house. So yeah. But yes, it's incorporating income and home price data. Now, of course, that's sort of the setting. So what has happened is that there's been sort of this amazing peak in activity in Ventura County that we've watched unfold. So for example, population in Ventura County peaked in 2016. Right, and it's declined every single year since. The county's labor force, the number of people who live in Ventura County who have a job, peaked in 2012 and has declined steadily. And then amazingly, total economic activity, real GDP, peaked in 2007 and it was down 15% at one point. It's still down about 12.5% from that peak. And so there's just been a prolonged period of economic weakness. And we can really trace the origin of this weakness to housing affordability. And so one of the things that we've heard from employers, large incumbent employers, over and over again over the years is we can't attract and retain talent, even skilled high income talent. For example, Amgen is the largest independent biotech company in the world. It was founded in a garage in Thousand Oaks and grew to be a major engine of economic growth. And in 2017, they announced they were moving their entire human resources and IT functions to Tampa, Florida. They built a 135,000 square foot facility there. And they cited as the number one reason for the move, cost of living. That again, they were offering in many cases, you know, freshly minted MBAs, you know, very high salaries to come and work in Thousand Oaks. They would, you know, look at housing prices and say, I can't possibly accept an offer there. And so there has been a real connection between housing affordability and decline in economic activity. In fact,
let me interrupt real quick. It's worth asking to make sure that we don't take anything for granted. Is there any other consideration of cost of living besides housing that could be unique to Ventura County?
Well, so what they cited at the time was cost of living and opportunities for growth. So just a general attitude about, you know, the flexibility, you know, about a community attitude about growth, not just about building residential housing, but about, you know, changes to their campus where they're working, that sort of stuff.
But that's sort of a second category within the cost of living category, and the ability to recruit and what the pay scale will be relative. Is housing the primary issue negatively impacting the cost of living? Or is there any, you know, for years I've found around the country, people have presumed that Southern California not only was more expensive for housing, but then auto insurance and groceries and whatnot.
Electricity, those things too, sure.
Okay, so you think there is a factor where those were problematic, unique to Ventura County?
Yeah, and I also think there's, you know, you also hear there's a lot of flight to lower tax regions as well from California. So these are all ingredients. But the one thing that sets Ventura County apart from its neighbors is the lack of residential construction and the extraordinary affordability crisis that results.
Yeah. And so when we look at these metrics put together, it strikes me as inescapable that you can't have costs going higher and people putting up with that, even as jobs are starting to leave and therefore economic opportunity is compressing to some degree, unless there's some issue distorting the relationship in these inputs with supply. That how can costs stay elevated and in fact increase above national mean or expectations in housing when the other inputs of wages and job opportunities are not, and your findings are that the answer is, lo and behold, we don't have enough housing.
Yep, Absolutely. Yeah. And again, in terms of job creation, we've added net new jobs every single year, with the exception of two recessions of recent history. But we're adding jobs almost exclusively in one sector, education and healthcare, which has an average salary in Ventura County of about $54,000. Meanwhile, the highest paying sectors of the economy, financial activities, management of enterprises, non-durable manufacturing, has seen sustained decline. You know, average incomes more like $150,000 have been in sustained decline. And so what's really interesting there is that, you know, it almost becomes a puzzle. How is it that home prices can continue to appreciate at a rate substantially faster than the nation, than neighboring counties, when you have a population and labor force in decline, economic activities decline? And the answer is, has to be supply, right? This has to be a supply story.
And of course, I would argue that that's the case nationally around the country, that where Absolutely. There are these problems of divergence, home price appreciation and not keeping up with wages and opportunity, creating unaffordability and in a lot of cases, migration, which we'll talk about in a moment, that it is largely a supply-driven epidemic. We had Dr. Edward Pinto from the American Enterprise Institute on the podcast in January talking about this very thing. Has that been your experience that some of that national conversation is sort of on steroids within Ventura County?
Yeah. In fact, interestingly, there's a connection here to our national forecasting work. So we were founding members of what at the time was called the Case-Shiller Home Price Expectations Survey. So we were invited by Robert Shiller to be part of the team that forecasted that. That has actually become known as the Zillow Home Price Expectations Survey. And so we have actually been forecasting U.S. home prices for a number of years and won three consecutive national forecasting awards, crystal ball awards for the Zillow Home Price Expectations Survey, you know, for having multiple top three rankings among the 100 forecasting houses that survey that data or that forecast that data. And interestingly there, sort of the insight we had was the importance of supply variables. And our focus on supply really put us out on the tail of the distribution of home price appreciation. You know, there were years where our forecast of U.S. home prices, home price appreciation was not only higher than the consensus, it was in some cases almost twice as high as the consensus. And it turned out that actually home prices appreciation came in even more rapid than our very, very strong forecasts. And so, yeah, there's definitely a nexus there. And we sort of see Ventura County as sort of the epicenter of that, of the supply challenge. And our focus there is actually informed even our national forecast.
Now, the person I'm about to reference was speaking to the city of Thousand Oaks, not the county of Ventura. But during the Q&A that you and I did together at the SURF event a couple weeks ago, your annual symposium where you graciously invited me to be a speaker, I believe it was a city councilman in the city of Thousand Oaks, and he referenced that there isn't an ability to add new homes, that at least within the city, that they seem to feel that they've kind of maxed out on where there is available opportunity. And I hear a lot that there is the belief that the land is scarce. What is your take on that at the specific level within Thousand Oaks and Ventura County? And then I'll parlay that to Dr. Pinto's idea nationally that there's a lot of suboptimal land use going on where those numbers may be true only because we're not utilizing code and entitlement to maximize opportunity, allow for duplexes and fourplexes to be built on single lots, things like that. What's your response? And maybe you could capture what his sentiment was sure. better than I did.
Yeah, so his comment really speaks directly to how the land use policies work in Ventura County. So again, we, back in 1998, imposed urban growth boundaries around the cities. And we did not, in that process, there was no plan for future growth. You know, they didn't set the growth boundary out into the, ag-urban interface some distance so that they could plan for future growth. We just set a growth boundary. And so it just took a few years to basically build out most of the undeveloped land inside those growth boundaries. And again, those growth boundaries can only be moved by a majority vote of the electorate. And this is something I know that you and Ed Pinto talked about in that episode of the podcast, which is that there's a profound problem of incentives in conducting policy that way, which is that the way we do it, by having to use the ballot measure process, you are basically allowing current homeowners to vote to preserve permanently higher home price appreciation, right? They can artificially limit supply and essentially vote themselves higher appreciation. And so, and I actually think that this sort of hints that SOAR, Save Open Spaces and Agriculture Resources, our land use policies are not only a challenge to economic growth, they're really a challenge to social cohesion, right? Because how is it that you can have a system where essentially well-to-do landowners can vote themselves permanently higher wealth accumulation at the expense of low and middle income workers who are priced out of the housing market? And so I think this is one of the real challenges. I do want to give the City of Thousand Oaks credit, and actually county officials and policymakers and other city managers' offices and city councils in other cities, which is there has been a real awakening to the problems that land use planning and the lack of housing development has produced. The City of Thousand Oaks actually did something really interesting where they actually looked at in their most recent general plan assessment, they looked at neighborhoods, and they actually recognized that a number of neighborhoods were actually built below allowed densities. And they said, oh my gosh, well, guess what? Let's rezone those neighborhoods to a lower density, and let's take those units of development that could have been built in that neighborhood and let's redistribute them throughout the city, and let's allow even greater development, you know, higher density development along transportation corridors. And so that's an example of policymakers trying to innovate within the restrictions that SOAR places. So there has been some really good work, but the reality is we have to expand the amount of developable land. And there is no shortage of undeveloped land in Ventura County currently.
You know, you're exactly right about the idea that there's a sort of NIMBYism that is driven by people's desire to promote their own wealth accumulation over the economic opportunity in the community. Although I think that that is right as far as the way we use the terms, and right conceptually, and that the NIMBYism of our day is, first of all, almost entirely bipartisan and cultural as much as it is political. But I also don't agree with them that they're actually accumulating more wealth. That what that wealth accumulation description is shorthand for is asset price inflation, as opposed to what we believe is actually real wealth accumulation, which is the production of goods and services. And that over time, the production of goods and services, the output in a community, in an area, in a country, leads to, as Smith famously taught us, the wealth of nations, right? In a sense, getting a boost in the asset price of your home while not producing more goods and services, because you've put away jobs, you've put away industry, you've put away commercial opportunity, you've disincentivized research and investment and capital expenditures and all of these things, I think that it makes for, in the aggregate, community to be poorer over time, regardless of what may feel like an asset boost at a moment in time.
I completely agree. So unless you're planning to sell your home in California and pass it on to your children who now live in Texas, or unless you are yourself planning to leave the high home value region, it is illusory.
And I would argue potentially not even sustainable for the asset holder. The hot potato could very well play out. There's a great arbitrage to sell an overpriced home in Orange County or Ventura County and buy an underpriced home in another part of the country. But most people are not doing that. And so what they get to hold on paper for a while may very well prove to be unsustainable. We shall see. That's not to predict these 2008 moments, but it is to simply comment on the historical reality that unaffordability creates a reversion to the mean.
I agree.
So in terms of the agenda of the center, it sounds very diversified. It sounds very impressive in where in different conversations and projects you get invited into. Tell me a little bit how this dovetails with the mission of the university. Is there a desire within the kind of worldview of your business school to contribute to national economic research? What is the kind of vision you have for the business college?
Yeah, so I think Ventura County is sort of an interesting place, actually, and I don't mean this in any way to be a slur on Ventura County. We often talk about Ventura County as Ventucky. You know, it's sort of this real down-to-earth, everybody knows everybody. It's really not that big a community. And California Lutheran University has sort of been a pillar in this community for a very long time. You know, you drive around town and, you know, you see Cal Lutheran alumni on license plate holders of every third or fourth car. And so it's just, Cal Lutheran has had really deep roots for a long, long time in a community where, you know, everybody sort of knows everybody, and everybody is willing to roll up their sleeves and do the hard work to address things like the COVID-19 pandemic. And so it just had a unique role. And I think SURF was brought in to really help cement that role in the community. Again, to sort of create greater national visibility for the university and reputational capital, but then to really give us a platform to try and serve the community even more than we have historically.
This is a message from our friends at American Habits from the State Policy Network. We the people. Do you ever think about what that means and what happened to it? We the people certainly did not mean an imperial city full of unelected bureaucrats deciding everything from kindergarten curricula to nursing home funding formulas. We the people mean self-government, a free people deciding most things in their families and communities and delegating some authority to their towns and states while passing along just a small amount of that power to the national government. How did things get so upside down at American Habits? We tell stories of real people with real solutions, all working to restore federalism and self-government. If you're a public official, come get involved. If you're a citizen, come and see the new standard for American leadership. No matter who you are, come help us renew the forgotten but not lost habit of American self-government. Visit AmericanHabits.org to learn more. That's AmericanHabits.org.
Are there particular resources that you need to do more of that? If you could wave a wand right now, would you rather have more students, more graduates, more academic professionals, more money? What are the resources
yes.
needed?
Yeah, yes.
All of the above. All right.
Yeah. So I guess some interesting dynamics are, you know, California Lutheran University. So I teach in the School of Management, and I actually only teach graduate students. So I have the privilege of teaching in a Master's of Quantitative Economics program. I teach a big part of the econometrics sequence, and so, you know, obviously, like almost institutions across the United States, we have seen declines in enrollment since COVID-19, right? And so we would love to see more students at the graduate and undergraduate level, for sure. In terms of the work that we do, so the Center for Economic Research and Forecasting is a self-sustaining organization, right? And so we do, a lot of the projects that we do are contract work. You know, we work with research sponsors or contractors who are funding the different initiatives that we're involved in. We raise some grant money as well, and so obviously that's great in the sense that it means that we're only compensated in proportion to how much value we create for the people that we're doing research for. But obviously, there's always a need. Where, you know, these days, like the entire nonprofit sector, we're always trying to raise funds to do the next year's work, and so students' money, all those things are things we're thinking about all the time. We've just had a we've been very blessed to have a really, really wonderful run here doing work that we think is important and impactful. And that what's nice is that focusing on value and impact has meant that we have hit all of our fundraising targets for the last 4 or 5 years. So it's worked really well.
Well, I think it's very impressive. I love the fact that there is not only opportunity for national application, but just this tremendous local specialization. The cliche that all politics is local has some truth to it, but all economics is somewhat local as well.
Oh yeah.
Particularly you hold to my worldview that economics is fundamentally allocation of scarcity. That is by definition micro, that branches out to macro. And so having some expertise and analytical skill around that in a city, town, community, county is profoundly important. And to see it attached to a Christian university is very, very encouraging. So how can people stay in touch with you? What would be the best website for folks to kind of stay connected to the work the center is doing?
Yeah, so the center's website is CLUCERF.org, so CLUCERF.org. And then one other website I direct people to is two others, actually. If you're interested in the Latino GDP project, that's latinogdp.us, latinogdp.us. And then lastly, we've been involved in this incredible initiative to seed the first groundwater market of its kind in California. We're actually launching another one in April in the Central Valley, and hopefully two more in that same county to follow later in the year. And that work is at h2omarkets.com, h2omarkets.com.
All those websites we'll add into the show notes as well, but evidence of just some wonderful things happening with the center. It's been good to get to know you. Look forward to ongoing discussions. I would love for you to come back and keep us up to speed every so often here at Capitol Record.
It's a real privilege to be with you. Thank you so much for having me, David.
Thanks so much. And thank you for listening to another episode of National Review's Capitol Record. Look forward to coming back to you again next week. We will have Dr. Art Laffer. I believe he'll be joining us for the fourth time on Capitol Record, Presidential Medal of Honor recipient, Reagan supply side economic guru, and a true friend and American patriot. So we'll be happy to have Art Laffer next week. And then going into a special month of April, Mentor Month. More on that soon. In the meantime, we continue to do our part to advocate for a free and virtuous society. And thank you for listening to National Review's Capitol Record.